episode is brought to you by Mubi, a curated streaming service dedicated to elevating great cinema from around the globe. From iconic directors to emerging auteurs, there's always something new to discover. With Mubi, each and every film is hand-selected. It's like your own personal film festival, streaming anytime, anywhere. In preparation for this year's Academy Awards, we recommend diving into Mubi's Oscar collection, and the Oscar goes to, where you can explore nominated films from various decades, including current Oscar nominee Sarah Polley's debut feature, Away From Her, starring Julie Christie. And the final film from the iconic Agnes Varda, Faces Places, whose face you'd see all over the Academy Museum gift shop if you ever get to visit.
For a limited time, you can try Mubi free for 90 days at mubi.com/letterboxd. That's mubi.com/letterboxd for 3 months of great cinema for free.
Mubi is for lovers of great cinema and those who don't know that they love great cinema yet.
This week on Best in Show, we're talking to the big cheese, the CEO of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, Bill Kramer. We're also previewing the British Academy of Film and Television Awards, and because it's Valentine's Day, we're chanting Down With Love! Peyton Reed's Down With Love, that is. Hi, and welcome to Best in Show, a limited podcast series brought to you by The Letterboxd Show. I am Mia Vicino, the West Coast editor here at Letterboxd, and Best in Show is all about award season. We're on the downhill run now to the Oscars via the BAFTAs, the Caesars, the Indie Spirits, and all of the Guild Awards. We're looking at the Letterboxd data on this year's contenders, we're having chats with special guests, and mostly, we're doing what we always do here at Letterboxd, celebrating cinema. Please welcome my Best in Show besties, Hollywood veteran, and our editorial producer, Brian Formo.
Howdy.
And our editor-in-chief, Gemma Gracewood.
Hello.
Also on our team, outside in the broadcast van with their unsweetened iced teas and their beans on toast, are our resident fact finder, Jax Fax, and the man with the tape deck himself, our editor, Slim. As always, thank you very much to these silent gents. And now, the news. We are going to cross now to Brian for a report from inside the Oscar nominees luncheon, where the big class photo of 2023 is taken. And the Academy have had finalists read love letters from Letterboxd.
This is Brian Formo reporting from the bowels of the 2023 Oscar nominee luncheon. This is being held at the Beverly Hilton. The luncheon itself is held next to the pool. It is a sunny day in Los Angeles, California. It's a great day for a luncheon. And because it's the day before Valentine's Day, we partnered with the Academy to deliver love letters from Letterboxd to many of the nominees who are here, and they are reading and reacting to a number of reviews. I got to deliver a trophy to Cate Blanchett. No, it wasn't an Oscar, though that might be on the way for Tar. It was a trophy from everyone listening. 8 million members made Cate Blanchett the most watched actress on Letterboxd of 2022. She did give a shout out to Peter Jackson for the Lord of the Rings work, which obviously helps her out in this case. But we had a lovely chat about Tar, Pinocchio, doing the dance, wearing the mask, all of that.
I can't tell you how exciting this is because, you know, I spent my early years in the theater, and so you know whether the auditorium's full or empty. And the fact that your home auditoriums or, you know, the auditoriums hopefully in the cinema itself, you know, in the dark with strangers watching these films that I've had the great good pleasure to be part of, I mean, that's the reason why we do it, so that you watch it. I can't tell you what this means to me. I'm bald over. That's amazing. Thank you so much.
That was Cate accepting her 2022 Most Watched Actress Award from Letterboxd users worldwide.
Oh, Brian, that sounded like a lovely lunch that I am not jealous of at all. Nope, not even one bit. So we're in a bit of an Oscars holding pattern right now. So can you tell us what's happening out there in awards land?
Wow, I'm back. I'm in both places at once.
Did you even bring us a bread roll? Just one measly bread roll from the Oscars luncheon,
please,
Brian,
with some bread, maybe Brian,
with Lydia Tarr's signature on it. I mean, come on.
Yeah. Of course we want a signed bread roll from Lydia Tarr. You didn't know that? how do you even respond to that?
I am merely blushing. The Oscar nominations are out. Voting has not started. That's why all the guilds, all those craft unions from everyone from producers to actors to editors, they're all lined up over the next few weeks. And the televised speeches at them really start to matter. It depends on what people are saying at these, because final voting closes for all the major guilds this week. And Oscar voting begins on March 2nd, and it's a tight 5 days. Voting closes on March 7th. So that's why everyone's rubbing elbows at this luncheon. We are really deep in the final hustle for votes. There's votes everywhere. You got to get them. Then the accountants do their thing and the envelopes get sealed.
It sort of reminds me of that movie Bob Roberts and like the whole riding around on buses. Are we in the riding around on buses full of journalists phase of award season?
We're in the space where journalists are invited less and less, and it's only about the elites. Then the accounts do their thing and the envelopes get sealed after everyone's rubbed elbows and I guess given each other signed autograph bread to try to get votes. Apparently that's an expectation that I've never heard about before, but I'll go with it. But we'll come back to the Oscars in a few minutes. We do have their CEO, Bill Cramer, waiting in the wings, but the BAFTAs are next. That is the big ceremony this Sunday, February 19th in London.
I was looking at the eligibility rules for the BAFTAs, and I like There's a detail from their new and improved rules that beverages and plonk-laden receptions are not permitted during voting round three. So I don't know if that like also excludes bread rolls, but I like the thought of very sober people making their choices between the Banshees of Inisherin and Brian and Charles for outstanding British film. Both films that are made much better with a glass of stout.
Gemma, can you clarify what plonk means?
for
those
booze.
Who may be in the dark.
For those who weren't colonized by the British and brought up with their vernacular, booze. Booze, Mia.
Ah, that's the big difference between the BAFTA and the Golden Globes, I see. Okay.
And the Spirit Awards, which are brought to you by Bullet Whiskey. So
this brings us to the London Film Critics Circle, speaking of British colonizers. So the last big Critics Award of the season, really, they took place last week in London, just like Magic Mike's Last Dance. And it seemed like an incredibly lovely night full of bright young stars and pip pip Cheerios.
Mia, I feel like you're stereotyping Brits.
Well, it is an Anglophobic stereotype. I was worried that that might be, so please don't cancel me. I'm sorry. I just like the phrase pip pip cheerio. I think it's cute. It's out of love. Tar was named Film of the Year at the London Critics Film Awards, making it only the fourth film in history to join a prestigious list of Best Picture winners among four major film critic associations, which are LA, New York, London, and the National Society of Film Critics. So here are the other history-making winners. Schindler's List, 1993. LA Confidential, 1997. The Social Network, 2010. And now, Tar, 2022.
Schindler's List was the only one of those that went on to win Best Picture from the Oscars, but that is a very nice list of bridesmaids, not the bride, that Tar is likely to join.
Oh, Brian. I'm still holding out hope for Tar as Best Picture.
Well, this type of data point is actually another area where I feel like award season is getting more like sports. I'm bringing it back to sports here. While Schindler's List is the only one of those that won Best Picture from the Oscars, all three of those did win Best Adapted Screenplay at the Oscars. Todd Field's Tar is in the original screenplay category at both the BAFTAs and the Oscars. It'd be nice if he could win there. I think we all agree, like he did at the London Critics critics' circle. And the rumblings that I've been hearing around Hollywood Cocktails, which is nicer than plonk-laden Spruce greetings, like much in the higher class realm. Kate Blanchett is keeping on the award season trail. Mostly what I've been hearing is that she's mostly been approaching this award season as trying to help Todd Field more than herself. She likes to take a step back from where she is in Best Actress. She's won, but she would really like to see Todd join her in the ranks of winning. So her London Critics speech was certainly pretty short. She said that she was just there to introduce Todd. So maybe she's starting to have her Frances Fisher era where she's going to eventually just say, you know, Martin McDonagh has already won a BAFTA and an Oscar, so let's give Todd this because it took him 16 years to make a movie.
And what a movie that came out. I see why it took 16 years. I'm just saying.
Yeah. Honestly, and that screenplay and the whole preamble to the screenplay where he's like, this might look like it's going to be this many minutes, but it's actually this many minutes because of what the music's going to do in it. And I just love that. Anyway, it's interesting, isn't it? Because Kate being reportedly opposed to the spotlight on her this season perhaps leaves space for Michelle Yeoh to take home the BAFTA for leading actress if it doesn't go to the also very deserving Viola Davis or Danielle Deadwyler. At the very least, though, for Michelle, the London Film Critics gave her the Dilys Powell Award for Excellence in Film. Brian, you asked me before the show who Dilys Powell was, and I'm so glad you asked because I had a look and she's my new favourite ghost. Dilys was the film critic at the Sunday Times for around 5 decades from 1939. What a year to start as a film critic. And she was an absolute champion for the art of cinema. Her manifesto reads like a sort of ardent Letterboxd member. It might be crude to say, but I don't care. A fabulous blog by Frederick on film that I read tells us that the first winner of the Dilys Powell Award was Dirk Bogarde. And Frederick writes that Dirk wrote a beautiful introduction to The Golden Screen, which is a collection of 50 years of Powell's writing that's now very much on my birthday wish list. He wrote about his friendship with Powell. Here's a sample. Playing a small part in a not very remarkable French film, she said of me, tartly but not unkindly, given too little to do, Mr. Bogarde does far too much. And he goes on to say, which was precisely what I did and how I learned from that phrase. They became friends and remained so for life, it seems. Mia, Brian, I would love to know which actor you would love to become friends with by writing some spicy Letterboxd reckons about their performances.
Oh, I mean, it's... Who remembers when I watched every single Robert Pattinson movie, all 28 of them? And so I had... Some of those were real flops, so I would have to say him. I have said some spicy stuff about that guy. And I think he's cool enough that he would understand and actually respect me for it. So yeah, that's my answer. Brian?
I mean, I guess I have to say Kirsten Dunst because she's on my bucket list. And I've written so many nice reviews about her, and I did have an interview lined up for her with Woodshock that was canceled after reviews came out. So I would like to think that the very nice things that I've written could eventually start
that. Wow, Brian choosing peace.
I love that a lot. And, you know, becoming lifelong friends. I just love Dirk saying, and how I learned from that phrase. I mean, you know, it's what film criticism is there for, right? I love the fact that I've just only just discovered Dilys Powell. I'm excited about my future with Dilys's writing. But back to Michelle Yeoh. I'm excited, drum roll please, a little plug here for something that we've done with our friends in London. Many of you will have heard of Girls on Tops Tees, a small collective that began as an idea. What if we could have filmmaker t-shirts just like we wear band t-shirts, right? It's a completely genius idea, and they're a tiny group of friends who pour their profits into writing by women and non-binary writers on film, and I obviously proudly own the Jane Campion tee. Mia, do you have one?
Yes, I do. I have the Julia Ducournau one, which I purchased when feminist body horror masterpiece Titon came out last year, and I am about to add another one to my collection with this Michelle Yeoh release. So Girls on Tops have done a few collabs over the years, and they came to us long before award season about a collaborative tea celebrating the Michelle Yeoh. And that was obviously a no-brainer because Michelle is, in the words of Letterboxd member Cressa Maeve Beer, the most balletic, beautiful, badass ever to grace the screen and high-kick her way into our hearts. So, yep, you are about to see Michelle Yeoh's name across many chests in the distinctive Girls on Tops black text on white. Stand by for the drop and order your own tea directly from girlsontopsteas.com.
Brian, do you have a Girls on Tops tea that you wear on your top?
I do. It says Sandy Powell, who is my favorite costume designer of all time. She also once dressed Kate Blanchett, probably more than once, but I'm thinking of Carol specifically. Oof. So I'm bringing it back to Kate Blanchett, who did win at the London Critics. And at the London Critics, it was also an acting sweep for The Banshees of Inisherin. There was a tie for foreign language film between Decision to Leave and The Quiet Girl. Also, Aftersun won a couple of gongs, including Breakthrough British-Irish Filmmaker for its writer-director Charlotte Wells and Young British-Irish Performer for Frankie Corio. And Letterboxd fave Florence Pugh won British-Irish Actress of the Year for her body of work. And Don't Worry, Darling, glad to see that get mentioned somewhere. Puss in Boots, The Last Wish, and The Wonder.
Sticking to the UK, the BAFTAs are this weekend. That show will be aired on the BBC and in other territories like the US on the BritBox app. They'll be hosted by the always delightful Richard E. Grant.
I'm going to give a little tea leaf tip to listeners because there's a ton of overlap between the membership at both the BAFTAs and the Academy itself, particularly in the acting branch. So if any of places where Banshees is nominated in the big categories but does not win, it's a good indicator of who might be the front runner from here forward. For instance, if Austin Butler beats Colin Farrell for Elvis versus Colin's Irish production of Inisherin, then Butler is probably the front runner in the home stretch.
Well, speaking of Elvis and the Colonel, that great bully, I was really interested in some paperwork changes that the BAFTAs have made. They've added new eligibility requirements for next year. So BAFTA is introducing, did you know this, a mandatory anti-bullying and harassment policy requirement as part of eligibility for all of its awards from 2024 onward. So for the film awards, this means that UK-based production companies will be required to have a policy in place, like as they're producing their film, to tackle issues of bullying and harassment on set and, I guess, in the wider production of a film, in order to be able to enter the two UK-only categories, Outstanding British Film and Outstanding Debut of a British Writer, Director or Producer.
Ah, okay. So this is just a UK stipulation, and other countries' productions can continue to bully and harass to their heart's content. Wow, great.
Yes. Lydia Tarr is safe here as the American expat in Germany. She can continue to do what she does. But in all seriousness, the Oscars themselves are doing an eligibility requirement that is also kicking into gear next year. So beginning in 2024, eligibility for the Best Picture Oscar will be subject to new representation and inclusion requirements announced by the Academy back in September 2020. So they've had 4 years to prepare for this. Are you ready? From 2024 onward, a film must meet two of the four of the following standards to be deemed eligible for Best Picture: on-screen representation, diversity in the creative leadership and project team, diversity in industry access and opportunities, which is paid apprenticeships or internships, or representation in development, marketing, and distribution.
Aha. So for all of those who say awards don't matter, they're just silly, why are you doing an entire podcast season called Best in Show focusing on awards? There's a bit of reverse engineering going on here, right? So in order to be eligible for Oscar or BAFTA, you have to not be a dick. And honestly, frankly, 2 out of 4 ain't hard. It should be 4 out of 4. It's what all New Zealand films have to do to meet our public funding guidelines, and many other film commissions around the world have the same rules. I think it's neat.
I do too. And speaking of neat, it is time to neatly step behind the curtain for a chat with the man behind the Oscars curtain.
Ooh.
The Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences not only puts on the Oscars and Brian's fancy luncheon every year, but it also extends invites for film professionals from all ranks to join as members and serve various governorships. Plus, it also runs a museum in the heart of Los Angeles where I can pop in anytime to see the handwritten script for Thelma and Louise or the Rosebud Sled from Citizen Kane.
Or buy the Spike Lee socks that I'm wearing right now.
Yes, or the Agnes Varda magnet on my fridge.
Or the bread roll signed by Lydia Tarr.
Put that in the Academy Museum. So it is a year-round job for many, including their new CEO, Bill Kramer, whom Brian and I were lucky enough to chat with about all the behind-the-scenes happenings, but also Pedro Almodovar, Double Indemnity, and the killer AI robot, Megan. Well, first off, thank you so much for being here, Bill Kramer. We really appreciate it. And thank you for bringing the Academy onto Letterboxd and letting us be a part of the luncheon and everything. It means the world.
We are so excited. We're super fans. We love what you guys are doing. We sit in the same space and it's just so exciting to partner with you. You're going to help us in so many ways. So I'm extremely grateful. So thank you.
I'm going to be attending my very first Oscars this year.
All right. You're going to have so much fun.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, I wanted to ask you about your first Oscar ceremony that you attended. Can you tell me anything about that and reminisce?
Oh, my gosh. It feels like yesterday. It was in 2012. That was the year of Hugo and The Artist. I remember the win that I was most excited about was for A Separation, which I think is just a flawless film, and it won Best International. But it was as glamorous and dynamic and compelling and exciting as I thought it would be. And I still feel that way about the show. But attending in person is a sort of out-of-body experience. You can't believe that you're in the room with every... You know, it's not just the celebrities, but, you know, visual effects artists and cinematographers who you love. They're standing right there. It's hard not to fanboy out over everybody that you're standing in the middle of the room with, but it's just so amazing to bring the industry together. It's all about the arts and sciences and the artists of movie making. And, you know, we're bringing all of the awards back on air live this year. I won't give away too much, but we just spent about a half a day with our show producers going over the board, each act of the show, and it's looking incredible and very much focused on the disciplines, the collaborations that go into movie making.
And you brought up that you're bringing back all the awards live, televised live again this year. I'm curious, what is that relationship, listening to feedback from the audience at home and people in your community, that you'd take to heart?
That's a great question, because I think it opens up that conversation around stakeholder groups. There's so many people who engage with the Oscars, right? It's sort of like concentric circles. And I'll start with the one that's closest to us, our membership. We have over 10,000 members, international members, who are engaged in movie making. You know, we have branches of the Academy connected to editing and cinematography, costume design, acting, all of the disciplines that go into movie making. That's what our membership is. And they were not thrilled. And I should back up and say, I appreciate the experiment. I think this was an attempt to see if the show could look and feel a little different. I don't think it was fully effective, but I appreciate the try. And then we listened to the feedback. So sometimes you have to do something to really understand if it's going to work. We talked about this in the abstract for many years. But our mission, our core values at the Academy is about equity across branches and disciplines. And we never want to make one branch feel like they're less important than another branch. There's no movie without hair and makeup. There's no movie without sound design. So I think it's set a strange tone and perhaps not the right message, but we're pulling that back in. And all of the awards are live on air. And that's how it should be. So, you know, our members are much happier. But I also think the viewing public, if done properly, if it doesn't extend a show for 40 hours, which it's not going to, it can be entertaining and dynamic and exciting. And we didn't save time last year. That was the interesting part of it. So why not pull it into the show and organically have it integrated into the conversation, all of those 8 awards that were pulled off? So I think it's going to help with our membership, the film industry, film lovers, and people who watch the Oscars to learn about movie making.
Yes, I am so happy that they're all going to be televised live again. And speaking of, will there be live music performances at this year's Oscars? I have to ask, because I'm a major Mitski fan, and she and David Byrne are nominated. So
I know the definite answer, okay. But I don't want to give away too much. But all I can say
I
think you'll be very happy. I think you'll be very happy. And it is exciting to think about, you know, Gaga, Rihanna, David Byrne, uh-huh. They're going to be on stage at the Oscars if this all works out. And that is the plan. But it's been a great year for music in film.
Which roles in the filmmaking community would you maybe like to see have a larger presence in the Academy membership, you know, since we're celebrating all aspects?
All branches are equal. We love all of our children equally. It's funny, you know, when we open the museum, everyone asks, what's your favorite object or exhibition? But I think it's really important to say that this, you know, we have to look at this in an equitable way. And again, if there's no movie without the costume designers or the director or the producer or the executives, you know, so they all need to grow and evolve in tandem. And what's so fascinating now that I'm CEO of the Academy and I'm working with our membership in a different way and, you know, working with them on guidelines and rules for their branches and new members coming into their branches, you know, we have branch executive committees that are constantly thinking about how is our discipline evolving and how do we open up our lens a bit to think about new components of cinematography or sound design that need to be included when we're considering people for membership and how we're defining our branch. So there's this sense of evolution and inclusivity that is happening consistently across branches that's very exciting. So instead of saying, you know, I'd like to see more of one branch, I like seeing all of the branches evolve. And that's what they do. That's how our members, you know, they take their roles as members very seriously. Our governors do, our branch executive committee members do, and they're committed to evolving these areas. So I think the industry itself will constantly see this evolution. And we should be the Academy, if we're doing our jobs properly, will be reflective of that change.
I'm glad you brought up the Academy Museum because I love it. I've been there maybe like 4 or 5 times since it opened.
Thank you.
It's one of my favorite places to go in LA. So I'm not going to ask what your favorite exhibit is, don't worry. But I am curious, which room would you hunker down and live in? Because I'd be in the Almodovar room.
Oh, okay. So you stole my thunder. And wait, hang on for 1 second.
Yeah.
I'm not on camera except for the two of you, but I should have had this at the ready, but no one's seen this yet, but this is coming out soon. This is our Pedro Almodovar catalog.
Wow.
That is all about that installation. We worked on with Pedro, who was so, of course, as amazing as you think he's going to be, he's the best and was so thoughtful and collaborative and kind and creative. And that gallery, that installation, is such a reflection of the work that Pedro did with two of our curators, Raul Guzman and Jenny He. And I could live in that room. And I have to say, when I was running the museum, there were days where I would take my laptop, before the museum opened or after hours or if it was quiet and, you know, sit on one of the benches in there and just answer some emails. I just needed to be around that energy. And I'm a lifelong Almodovar fan. The whole thing is a thrill. And we're looking to tour that gallery, that installation. We're starting to have some conversations around that because it will be rotating out of the museum in about a year. But so proud of every inch of space in the museum. Jacqueline Stewart, who's now running the museum, is just remarkable. This weekend, I don't know if you attended any of our Regeneration Summit, but it was a three-day kind of gathering with screenings and panel discussions around the history of Black cinema tied to our massive and epic and beautiful exhibition, Regeneration, Black Cinema, 1898 to 1971. So if you haven't seen that, please do. It's so powerful, so beautiful. But if I'm picking one space to live in, it's the Almodovar space.
Those blues, those reds.
Oh, yeah. And it's him. You feel like you're in one of his films without being too on the nose about it. We had wonderful designer Shraddha Arel, who leads our exhibition design, really led the focus of you know, the design of the spaces in the museum. And I love hearing your impression of the museum because you're obviously a movie lover and have great knowledge of cinema. But I've often found pre-opening the Academy Museum that sometimes film exhibitions left me a little cold. You know, the thrill of watching a movie in a theater is, you know, you're watching the art in its final form. A gallery space around movie making, a film exhibition, should be just as thrilling as sitting in a theater and watching your favorite movie. Otherwise, you're going to lose the impact of the storytelling in the space. And I do think Pedro's installation captures the feeling of watching an Almodovar film, but you're learning about his process and his theme. So it's educational, but it's also dynamic and enjoyable.
I love that we're talking about Almodovar in a theater because actually my answer to this question is Almodovar. It's Talk to Her. It's the only time that I've ever watched a movie twice in the same day in the theater.
Wow. The best. Oh my God. That movie, I've seen it so many times and it's just stunning. It's a masterpiece.
Yeah. And so I have to ask, because we actually get asked this frequently through our social, how does the Academy verify that its members are watching the nominated films?
I want to say I picture you keeping them in a room, forcing their eyes open, Clockwork Orange style.
Clockwork Orange style, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, but we have eye drops for everyone, so no one's eyes fly out. So we have the Academy screening room, and for certain categories, international, animated, you know, to opt into voting for the shortlist, you have to have watched X percent of the movies that are eligible for nomination. You know, our branch executive committees track this. Our international feature film committee tracks this. There's a little bit of an honor system, so we can track what happens on the Academy screening room. But we also ask our members, if you didn't watch it there, where did you watch it and when? So it's a little bit of tracking, a little bit of an honor system. But we hope that everyone is being totally honest about that, right?
I'm a huge Kirsten Dunst fan. So I loved last year when she said that it's her duty as an Academy member to watch everything.
Absolutely. Yes. I mean, please, this is not a hardship, but it is the duty of a member to do this. At voting, people should take it very seriously. Or if you're having a year where you're on set and you're working a lot and you can't watch a lot of the shortlisted films, you know, people will opt out sometimes. And I think that's the responsible thing to do. I would say the members who I work with closely take their responsibility very seriously.
While we're on the subject of our favorite films, so Bill, we have researched you and we learned a couple things about your favorite films.
By the way, that list can change depending on the day for all of us, I'm sure.
Oh, yes, absolutely. But I got to bring up Clute, especially.
I have a big Clute poster right here.
You do? Oh, yeah. Good.
I'll turn the camera when we're done.
Yes. So the other films, I just had to say Clute first, but Clute, Double Indemnity, Tokyo Story, Lady Eve, Sweet Smell of Success. So these are amazing choices. But which films had the greatest impact on you as an audience member?
So I'll choose one of those. Well, two of them. Tokyo Story. And I love the fact that more and more you're seeing this film on top 10, top 100 lists. Ozu is a master of composition. I'm a very visually driven person. So I remember seeing that film for the first time decades ago. I'm not young. And thinking, oh, filmmakers are like painters or architects, and they're creating, they're composing a scene, a set, and that composition sends a signal to the audience. And of course, if you went to film school, you get that. Or if you are more knowledgeable about cinema history, you get that. At the time, I did not. And it made me start exploring the components of movie making and the psychology behind how scenes are framed and shot. And that's a very sort of straightforward film to discuss when it comes to cinematography and you know, production design and set decoration, because it's very thoughtful and I think it's very apparent to the eye. But I'm also, you know, I'm obsessed with architecture and the sort of use of space and the character's placement in space said so much. So that was a moment where I started looking at movies differently. And it's just so beautiful. And the story is so universal. Double Indemnity was the first time, again, first time I saw it was decades ago. I have to say, where I'm living now, my husband and I have a house in the Hollywood Land development. So we're sort of under the Hollywood side, and we live a few houses away from the house that Barbara Stanwyck lived in Double Indemnity. And when we were going to look at this house, I almost drove right into it. I couldn't believe what I was looking at. It was like a fever dream. But what, you know, I love that film for so many reasons, but I think she's a genius, and just the way she uses her body and her humor, you know, that both that character and just Stanwyck as an actress was so compelling to me, and so both funny and dangerous, like great film noir. All of those elements are there. But it's also a nod to a moment in LA history that's very interesting to me. And, you know, I love looking at LA history through, you know, historical films, especially of that era.
We talked about doing a little research on some of your favorite films, but we also wanted to ask something that that we couldn't research, which is, and we did this for ourselves at the start of this year, which is, okay, so, but you're in charge of the biggest awards nomination group in the world. But we're curious, what is an award that you won early on that was small? So for instance, like I won the Hustle Award for basketball. Mia won her example. She got a little trophy for guessing the Oscars at the most right. Was it last year? So
Last year I did. I got a trophy for it. No big deal.
What is a minor trophy that you've gotten?
Oh my gosh. I mean, I was a big baseball player as a kid and won lots of Little League trophies. But I can't think of one specifically by title, but I'll say something embarrassing about a superlative I won. It wasn't a trophy, but I was voted most cheerful in my high school, which is something I'm teased about constantly by all of my friends from high school. But that was the sort of, you know, I feel like with Little League trophies, everyone gets a star. You know, that didn't matter as much, but when that happened, that kind of solidified a running joke that has not stopped for, you know, almost 50 years now.
That's a great superlative.
Yeah, we need more cheer in the Oscars. We need more cheer everywhere.
We need more cheer everywhere.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, speaking of trophies, I got to get into Oscars history a little bit. So there have been 6 ties. And if you could add a 7th, which performance or film would you bestow an Oscar to without taking away the winner?
Oh, so interesting. I mean, I have a million of those running through my head. I have to be careful here.
Mm-hmm.
I
know yes, exactly.
That's our esteemed Academy membership, but Lupita's performance in Us a few years ago, where it was really 2 performances, to me is just a masterclass in acting. And so surprising. And I've seen that film so many times because I just want to watch her act. I would love to retroactively go back and have her share the award. But I think about that as a miss. But, you know, look, it's all subjective.
Yeah.
People feel many ways, but I feel like that was an acting exercise and performance of note that sort of went unnoticed that season. And not just by us, but it just didn't hit with critics, or with critics it did, but with, you know, the awards cycle, it didn't seem to as much. And I just think she's remarkable. And I thought that performance was just beyond anything I had seen before.
Yeah, and I think when we look at additional membership, a lot of people focus in certain areas, but I think horror as a genre is something that we'll start to see like build its way into this space.
I hope so. That's a great point. I wasn't even really thinking about that, but I think you're right. I mean, I think what's been so interesting over the last year, especially as people are, I'm doing air quotes for the viewers at home, coming back to the theaters. I know we're not where we were before the pandemic, but horror plays well in theaters. And we want people to go to the movies. We want people to see movies in theaters. And I feel like we're seeing horror, even Megan, which is sort of comedy horror. But, you know, I loved seeing that in a theater with an audience. And I'm hoping more and more our members will take horror as a genre seriously, beyond just maybe technical aspects of a horror or thriller, not just horror, but thriller films as well. Because, you know, to create that sort of tension and to create that feeling in the audience is incredibly difficult. And we shouldn't diminish the value of these films. But I do think we have some directors, Ari Aster, one of them, who I think are doing really interesting things in that genre and sort of elevating it in ways that may make it more palatable for the awards circuit. I hope so.
Nice to see Megan getting some Academy love. Yeah. It's what she deserves.
Yes. Yes. The wonderful Allison Williams.
Oh, yes.
Along with Riz did our nominations announcement.
Yes.
Yes. Oh, we watched. Yes.
I had no doubt. I had no doubt. But, you know, we love that movie. You know, Jason Blum is very close to the Academy. Love what he's doing. He's keeping the industry so fresh and exciting and developing new generations of moviegoers. So, you know, we need more of this. We need more of this.
So as we tragically reach the end of our chat,
wow,
I have one more.
Fast.
I know, time flies when you're having fun.
Those are fun.
Once the Oscar ceremony is over, what is your after party? How do you unwind, let off that steam?
I never unwind. I'm always at work. You know, I have an amazing husband. We have a great social life. We're big Pilates devotees. So that's a huge stress reliever for me constantly. It'll be a stress reliever the day before the Oscars. So that never stops. You know, post-Oscars is a moment for us to really reflect. You know, we have a fiscal year, but really, if you think about the cycle of the Academy, it's, you know, Oscars to Oscars. We're going to be doing a lot of thinking post-Oscars about what's next, about campaign regulations and things that we have to look into. How are we evolving the industry? So you leave that show and I promise to relax. I know everyone thinks I work too much, but I enjoy this. Work is fun for me. But I want to use that time along with all of our amazing committees and our governors and our amazing team at the Academy to really think about the evolution of our institution and what's next. So, you know, I think there's a lot of exciting thinking and doing work that will set us up for future shows and beyond. And also, you know, at the Academy, we do so much more than just the Oscars. We have amazing talent development programs, our museum. We have the largest film-related collection in the world at our library and our archive and museum. So that work is 365 days a year. And you know, we turn a lot of our attention to that after the show. So there will be some chilling out, but not that much.
Mia mentioned that she gets to go with Gemma to the press room for this. I turned down being able to go because I actually don't, I feel like I need to not work for a little bit. And I want to have, it's been 10 years since I could have people over to like watch the Oscars with me. And I am so looking forward to doing that as a spectator again at my home.
That's great. That's just as important. We need people watching the show. Turn on all of the TVs in your house and tell all of you to do the same. What we've seen so far, the set design, the red carpet, the lineup of presenters, you know, this commitment to really digging into the disciplines of movie making. I think it's going to be a really fantastic night. Jimmy's been amazing to work with and his team. I love the return to sort of someone who's used to doing live television. I think that really grounds the show. I thought Trevor Noah did a great job at the Grammys last night for the same reason. So you'll have to let us know how we looked on TV.
Will do. I'm looking forward to it. I hope Megan is there.
I'm not giving anything away.
No spoilers.
We're going to have Megan and Cocaine Bear going out.
Well, every awards show has that moment when the lighting rig comes down from the rafters, the confetti is swept away, the chairs are stacked, and the last balloon drops as two people quietly hook up in a darkened corner. That's right, it's after party time. Woo! Gemma, Brian, it is Valentine's Day when this episode drops, so we are revisiting Academy non-award winner Down with Love, which stars Renee Zellweger and Ewan McGregor. It's 20 years old this year and was directed by Ant-Man director Peyton Reed. But why is it relevant to awards season, Gemma?
I mean, honestly, just look at Letterboxd reviews to make anything relevant to anything. For example, here are two reviews from the last week on Letterboxd of Down With Love. Jamie Carrick writes, 5 stars, I would like to live in the universe where David Hyde Pierce won the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor for this film. So would I. And Abs asks, how do I get this to win Best Picture at the 2023 Oscars? Only movie ever. And then Cassie tagged Best in Show in their review, because we did warn you last week we'd be watching this. This is peak cinema. The swanky soundtrack, colourful set design and cheeky humour are top notch. Renee and Ewan's performance are absolutely delightful, and I would sell my soul to have Barbara Novak's apartment and her wardrobe.
Oh, if we're highlighting reviews, I have to jump on the David Hyde Pierce train with a little side of Sarah Paulson love mixed in via the Fondas review, which concludes with, love to see queer actors who are pretending to be straight have way more chemistry than the straight leads. Now, in regards to awards, Renee Zellweger did win her first Oscar the same year. It's a different movie, but it was for 2004's Best Supporting Actress for Cold Mountain. But Down With Love did win the much-coveted AARP Movies for Grownups Best Movie Time Capsule Award in 2004.
Woo-woo! Yes, my favorite awards, the AARP.
It was up against Seabiscuit and A Mighty Wind.
Parker Posey.
Yes.
And a horse.
Elvis won that award this year, and generally that award does seem to be given for like nostalgic reasons, but Time Capsule here is appropriate because Down With Love is not just set in the early 60s, but it's recreating the sex comedy of the era. It's like the ultimate time capsule.
Yes, absolutely. And specifically, it's a campy and cheeky send-up of the Doris Day and Rock Hudson, quote, no sex sex comedies of that time period. Now, with the category that we're highlighting it in, the coveted Time Capsule Award of 2004, it also won the award that I created for this show, the Heart Rate Award. For listeners who might be missing my little game, I brought it back just for Down With Love. So A Mighty Wind has the highest average of those nominees you mentioned with a 3.6, but Jax Fax has given us the envelope and Down With Love has a higher percentage of logs with a heart. Appropriate for this Valentine's Day episode, don't you think?
Absolutely, absolutely. But before we get into our own love of the movie, for those listeners who didn't watch or rewatch it in the past week and are no doubt going to watch it this Valentine's now because of us, can you give us a little background, a little synopsis, Mia?
Oh, Gemma, it would be my pleasure and my honor. So set in early 1960s New York City, our protagonist is feminist author Barbara Novak, played by Renee, who has just published a book called Down With Love, which proposes that in order to get ahead in the workplace, women must reject romantic love and embrace Sex a la carte. Ladies Man, Man's Man, Man About Town, Catcher Block, played by a swoon-worthy Ewan, is a Playboy journalist for a men's magazine, and he decides to go undercover to write an expose on Barbara by making her fall for him. And what follows is a screwball cocktail of mistaken identities, suave innuendo, dazzling 60s fashion, and lots of chocolate. So let's get down with love.
Okay, so the first and most important and pretty much the only thing I have to say about Down With Love is that its Letterboxd rating average is a perfect 3.5. It sits magnificently atop the Gemma line, as it should. What does 3.5 signify, you ask? I think a lot of people don't realize what I mean by this, by the fact that it's the perfect rating. But as any cinephile in their right mind knows, a 3.5 film is a five-star film that's just misunderstood.
Yes.
If I ever see a 3.5 rating for any of my trusted people, is instant watch list ad, because that means
thank you, Brian. It's
entirely worth everyone's time.
Exactly. But more excitingly, this is one of the films we call a high riser here at Letterboxd. So back when we began, those who were rating this film generally gave it an average of 3 out of 5. It's risen steadily over time. It's showing no signs of dropping off. And looking into the backstage stats, I've noticed a significant rise in 5-star ratings over the past year. What do you put that down to?
Maybe my placement of it in my top 4. I think I can take all of the credit for this one, and I would like to.
Go on.
No. But so 2003... was not a particularly feminist-friendly or, you know, like gay camp-friendly moment in American culture. And I do feel it was widely misunderstood by both mainstream audiences and critics alike upon release. But it's funny and sexy and smart, which are the three best things to be. And it's easily my favorite non-Hugh Grant rom-com. So it is very gratifying and validating for me to know that a cultural reevaluation is in progress.
It's so true. And we have the data to back it up, so you know it's true. Brian, bring it home. Bring it home with your Down With Love appreciation.
Well, this, I did rewatch it. This is my third rewatch, but I get extra credit because this is the first time that I've ever watched this after actually seeing Pillow Talk. I'm trying so hard to not say Pillow Book, which is a different Ewan McGregor 16-inch hose movie. But so this is the first. I've always really loved Down With Love, but I've kind of always had this same reading on it. Is like the first 45 minutes, I'm always like, this is the best movie comedy that has ever been made. And it reminds me so much. Everyone brings up Pillow Book for this, but it reminds, or sorry, everyone brings up Pillow Talk.
I mean, we've all got you and Pillow Book on the mind. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, Brian. Yeah. It's great. That's a 3. And I gave 3.5 to Pillow Book, by the way. So, but everyone brings up Pillow Talk for this. But what I respond to most is what it seems like it's recreating the Frank Tashlin, Jane Mansfield movies, which are very cartoonish, way more overtly sexual. And you'll see like milk jugs explode and things like that because she's so attractive. The girl can't help it. And it really embraces the rock and roll. And it's kind of very different from the Doris Day movies of the period because I think it is a little more sex positive or attraction forward leaning, which a lot of the beginning of Down With Love is. But then it does kick into where it basically is like a recreation of Pillow Talk, which is the mistaken identities. And so now that I've seen Pillow Talk, I'm like, oh, it's actually like, yeah, it completely segues into doing that. And I love Down With Love throughout, but I do kind of like the first half of that movie is absolutely perfect. The rest is very, very, very good. But I think I respond more to the Frank Tashlin type.
So 5 stars for the first 45 minutes, 3.5 stars for the rest.
Yeah, which gives it a magnificent 4-star rating from me.
I don't know. My maths was, I was going to say, which gives it a 7.5 out of 5. So, you know, smashing it out of the park. AARP,
7.5
know what's
out of 5. Yes, that math seems correct. That's what I would give it. Gemma, do you have any additional thoughts?
Only that every time Ewan McGregor comes on a screen, my brain goes, boo.
I know. he has his dark hair, his suave suits. When he bites into the chocolate, oh, I cannot think about this. I have to distract myself.
Like, it's so insane that you just have to hear his voice in Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio as a silly little cricket and feel horny.
Well, I think that actually, because around the 45 minute mark is when he switches to his fake Texan voice. And then we rely on David Hyde Pierce and Sarah Paulson to give us all the sexual verve back, because it just droops when he starts talking with his twang.
I know, I'm on board. I'm on board with the fake accent. Mia, how do you feel about Ewan McGregor talking or singing or just like existing?
I'm positive on all fronts. Extremely positive. This is my favorite role of his. Sorry, Moulin Rouge. I'm sorry. This is my Ewan. This is my Ewan. So I have a Mia fact. Yes, it's true. I'm breaking into the fact business. Two-time Oscar winner Renee Zellweger and future Oscar nominee, hopefully, Ewan McGregor, specifically requested to sing an end credit song because he was in Moulin Rouge and she was in Chicago, which are both Academy Award-winning musicals. See? We're tying it into award season. Look at that.
You brought it all home. You brought it all home. Mm-hmm. Therefore, Down With Love is effectively an Academy Award-winning film.
Yes, we have declared it so.
All right, it is time to put a pin in the little helium balloon of Down With Love and move on from Valentine's Day and step sideways into our final segment, Player of the Season, which is where we mention a person or an organization or an event or something that's happened in the last week in the awards season landscape that nudges film culture forward. Even just a little bit. So do we have any nominees this week for Player of the Season?
Yes, I would like to read two sections from The Woman King's director, Gina Prince-Bythewood, who wrote for The Hollywood Reporter about the lack of nominations for Black-directed movies, particularly those made by women. We just very clearly saw that social capital is more valuable than studio power. That type of power is exercised in more casual ways in social circles, where folks are your friends or your acquaintances. There may be diversity on your sets, but not in your lives. And Black women in this industry, we don't have that power. There is no groundswell from privileged people with enormous social capital to get behind Black women. There never has been. Also, I think about my craftspeople. They did extraordinary work, and for most of them, it was their first time in a film of this size. I had to fight to get them on my crew because they didn't have the resume. Having an Academy Award or any of these Guild Awards on their resumes, the next time they go up for a job, they don't have to have that fight. But when we're not afforded this type of recognition, so many of them have to start back at square one.
So true. And look, if Letterboxd members were Academy voters, The Woman King has a stonking 3.8 average. It's been seen by almost 100,000 members. And the reviews alone are they're not the trophy, because obviously you need the trophy to get the opportunities. But I just like to say Letterboxd hasn't forgotten The Woman King.
And it's important to note how our chat with Bill Kramer, the CEO of the Academy that we just heard from, he keeps noting that the membership needs to continue to grow, but also try to investigate their own comfort zones with genres and the filmmakers they're supporting. Like he said, it's a 365-day-a-year job, and it'll be interesting to see what bylaws come at the end of this award season in regards to social capital campaigning. You should read the whole piece. We'll drop it in the episode notes. But what Gina has written, that final section that we read aloud, is a perfect reminder that so much of the award season is about the jobs you get after you're nominated. And it becomes less and less about the films we're talking about in the running and more about every craft and crew person's future jobs that they receive from this goodwill. And if you don't have the same level access to begin with, you need award nominations to get even further.
And bread rolls. Access to bread rolls.
Signed by Lydia Tarr. Anyone can save diversity. It's Lydia Tarr. Thanks for listening to Best in Show, a limited award season series brought to you by The Letterboxd Show. We would love for you to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts to help us spread the word as we barrel towards the end of the season.
You can follow us and our HQ page on Letterboxd using the links in our episode notes. We'd love to thank our crew, Jack for the facts, Slim for making us sound amazing, Sophie for the episode transcript, and Letterboxd member Trent Walton for the music, and you for listening.
Thank you for sharing this journey with me every day of it. Without you, there would be none of this. Thank you for dreaming so much bigger than I would ever dare to dream and making me believe. I love you.
Aww.
Best in Show is a Tape Deck production. That was Renee Zellweger.
But not Ewan.
Someday.
This is a Tape Deck podcast.